Check, check, check. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm very sorry for keeping you waiting. Cows are not always the most cooperative. Even if you tell them you got church on Sunday.
That's okay, you were waiting
for it. Wow. Somebody's really trying too hard. Wow. You got an apple somewhere too? All right, so the book of Judges, chapter 19, where we're starting. All right, so I asked you to consider pre-reading some of this. So it's quite the story. My marker started off strong, but not continued. The moral mess. So, try not to shake up your ears this morning. How many times do you think about situations, whether it's with your family, your children, or in the world at large, that are so complicated as to try and determine what's the right thing to do? What do we do at this point? How do we figure out what's justice and what's injustice and what's the right balance? Okay, so think about the complexities that we've seen just in our time. Okay, some of you probably remember the Rodney King incident. Okay, remember that Rodney King, he had really angered the police. They took out their anger on him. But then the jury found the police innocent, and then there was a riot, and then a guy named Denny something. I can't remember Denny's first name, but he was dragged out of a truck and beat up with bricks and stuff by some of the rioters. You remember that? Reginald Denny. What was his name? Reginald Denny.
Oh, good memory.
So, or we can look at what's just happened in Washington with Trump pardoning people from the January 6th riots. Is that justice? Is it injustice? Okay. Now, there were police officers hurt on that day. Okay. People were rioting. People did the wrong thing. Should they be locked up for 20 years? Are all of them just as responsible as everybody else? What do you do in a riot? Okay? How do you execute judgment properly? And so that's just a couple of big, flashy, newsworthy type items. We can look at our own families, right, where somebody steals from somebody else in the family, but it doesn't get caught right away and it drags on, and then it's like, well, should they give the money back? What do they do with the money? Were they helping somebody else? Things get messy in the world, right? People and relationships are messy and they're complicated, and it reminds me of Humpty Dumpty, right? All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Right? And we make these messes that are too complicated. Okay, I've had the children, when they were younger, one of them steals popsicles and gives them to the other kids. Okay, now, how do you discipline for that? Right? Because did the other children know that the popsicles were stolen? Well, you ask them, and they're like, well, so-and-so told me that they asked you, and you said that we could all have a popsicle. Well, that was true. That did happen. that they did tell the kids that. But I also say to the little ones, yes, but you had already asked me for a popsicle just a little bit before that, and I said no. So you knew that I had said no, and then suddenly, magically, so-and-so brings popsicles for everybody, right? And so then you have to deal with the one who caused the other ones to sin. You got to deal with the ones who sinned to a lesser degree. You have all these levels of complexity. And, you know, I talked to the ones who would do the ultimate deceiving about, look, you didn't just sin, but then you caused everybody else to sin in a domino effect afterwards. Okay, and so as we read this story in Judges, we're going to see even multiplied over what we saw last week, right? Last week we had the guy who was just like, hey, you know, I think I don't want to walk all the way to the tabernacle anymore. I'm going to start my own thing. And he melts some silver, makes an idol, gives himself a priest outfit, puts it on his kids. Then a wandering Levite comes by, hey, you be my priest. And he's like, since that Levite wandered by, God must be blessing what I'm doing. Because otherwise this Levite wouldn't have shown up, right? But then eventually a big army comes by and they want the Levite. And they say, stop talking or we'll do something bad to you. We're taking your priest. You know, it's just, it goes on and on. That just the wrongs, the moral mess or morass, the moral malaise of this people is profound. Okay, and we're going to see today kind of what could really be described as kind of the bottoming out of the Jewish society at this time. So starting verse chapter 19. And it came to pass in their days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Now a concubine is a slave wife. Okay, so he took on a wife who was essentially his slave. Okay, so that's kind of how you can think about this. Whether he had other wives, a legitimate wife or not, we're not told. But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah and was there for 4 whole months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back, having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. All right. What is the first institution created by God?
Marriage.
Okay. Where is Satan's attack perpetually in our society?
Okay. Yes.
On marriage, on family. Okay? So marriage here, we see right away, has... I'm sorry about the noise from this microphone. But marriage is trashed. And why can I... How can we derive this truth from just what we've already read? What are your contexts?
That he is even taking a concubine?
Okay, he's got a slave wife, so the taking of a concubine in the first place. Okay?
Well, that Jesus, he's made her a slave. Eve wasn't a slave.
Right.
That wasn't the way marriage was.
Right. So he's already created an illegitimacy to his marriage here, especially as a priest. So we can say right off the bat that he's violating Genesis 2:24, where God sets up marriage in the first place. And what else demonstrates for us that marriage is being trashed?
She was unfaithful.
She played the harlot. Okay? So then what? Now it's going to get tougher for you, okay? Tougher in the sense that the statements you're going to make are a little bit more black and white and a little bit more profound and put the finger on the sore spot a little bit harder. What was the mandate on the children of Israel to do with a wife who played the harlot?
Stone. To be stoned.
Yeah, death.
Yeah.
All right. So the Levite took on an inappropriate wife for himself. Now, what again is a Levite? One of the leaders of the religious side of the society. He's the pastor. Okay, he's the traveling pastor. They have the tabernacle, they have the high priests, and then the Levites are the traveling pastors. They have some designated cities, but they are supposed to be delivering the word of God to the people of Israel. That's their duty. That's their job. Okay? And so he doesn't know his own scriptures. He takes on a wife inappropriately. She commits harlotry. He doesn't go after her right away. He waits. Then when he goes after her, he goes to speak kindly to her, and he brings gifts for her father. Okay? And he doesn't accept what he ought to be doing, which, if you want to look up, is in Leviticus 20, verse 10. And then there's a final insult and a final very specific sin here that he does by failing to put her to death and bringing her back into his bed. He's now a priest married to a harlot. And that is also very specifically prohibited. And that's prohibited in Leviticus 21:14. Now, in our present society, we've all seen marriage being trashed. Okay? And I'm not just talking about the difficulties that happen, and I know for some of you have happened with marriage. And divorce is a part of the reality of the world we live in, the fallen world. That's why God gave divorce to the children of Israel, right? Because how do you deal with this mess that can happen within a marriage at times? And so I'm not talking about that specifically, because that's a problem that has persisted from the beginning. But how do we look at marriage right now in this society, in America right now, and say that marriage is being trashed? Give me some examples. Okay. Homosexuality. There's polygamy. What else? Yes.
People no longer getting married, they're just living together.
Yep, cohabiting. Although to some extent I would say that the cohabiting is a bit more of a consequence of the trashing, right? But what else?
Cheating,
yeah. Adultery is rampant. Here's where I'm trying to draw you to, okay? There's web pages to help you commit adultery. There was one very popular about 12 years ago called Madison something or other. Do you remember the name of it?
Ashley Madison.
That's
sorry,
right.
I don't know why I remember
that. No, that's
that
fine. It was a big news story at the time. Ashley Madison was a website to help you have an affair.
Do we need to talk?
Okay. So this is where I want us to go, right? We want us to think about, okay, Ashley Madison, there's web pages called Tinder and Grindr, right, that are all about hookup culture. They're all about quick and easy sex. That's what they're about. Okay? And then I'm going to add this because I think this is reality TV. And I don't say reality TV is the sin. Okay? But I want this as a statement to draw your attention to The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, all of these type of programs that are making marriage into a mockery. where they take 30 beautiful women and some eligible guy, and then they videotape them having shallow, nonsensical, comical interactions together. Do these little tests together. Try these little dates together. You know, and they bring up drama, and they let the women's group fight amongst each other and catty nonsense. I mean, it's just so shallow. I'm glad that some of you seem to be completely unaware of this, because at least you're not polluting your mind with just this absolute drivel that is on television. Okay, but it is permeating our society. Okay? It's just permeating our society. And then you get to the end of The Bachelor, and he gives the rose, you know, to the one girl, and they're in true love, and they rush off and get married right on the spot, and then, you know, there's the big news story, oh, they got hooked up, and they got married, and isn't it great? And it's like, they've already been sleeping together. He slept with 5 other women in the competition. This is trashing marriage. Okay, that's making a mockery of marriage. And I'm down in Lansing dealing with the repeal of numerous laws to protect marriage. And I'm like, when I first started, there's an old English law, I think it's called Lord Byron's Law, something like that, that says that if a couple is married and the woman has an affair and gets pregnant, the child is still legally the child of her husband's. Because the marriage covenant is stronger than blood. And we repealed that. Because we live in a society that says, oh no, the real father is the DNA donor. He has more rights than the man that the woman was married to. And I was one of 5 people to stand up and say, this is wrong. Don't do this. This is a bad idea. Protect marriage. And more recently, we just approved a law that basically removes all the shackles to who can be an officiant at a wedding. That was already crumbling. You can already go online and in 30 minutes become an officiant. But we removed even more barriers that the state had to who can be an officiant. And at the same time, we also repealed all the laws against cohabitation and a bunch of other things. And I'm like, what are we doing here? We're not strengthening families. We're not doing what helps families and children survive. We're just making it easier to do whatever you want in society. And we're trashing marriage. And this is a fundamental part of this nation's headlong plunge. And why I'm spending so much time on it with you right at this moment is because as we read the rest of this story, you're going to see how far the plunge goes. And it so starts up here with this original institution set by God. So let's continue. We can come back to some of these points if you want to talk about them more. Pick up at verse 4. Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Then it came to pass on the 4th day that they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way. So they sat down, and the 2 of them ate and drank together. Then the young woman's father said, please be content to stay all night, and let your heart be merry. And when the man stood to depart, his father-in-law urged him, so he lodged there again. Then he rose early in the morning on the 5th day to depart, but the young woman's father said, please refresh your heart. So they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. Now, different sources that I read as I looked into this, you know, is this just Middle East custom going on? Is the father-in-law trying to make sure that the husband and wife make up and that everything's okay? I don't know. I'm not sure what his motive is, and I thought the preachers who spent a lot of time trying to figure that out were kind of doing a lot of guessing. So I don't know what's going on.
Your guess is as good as theirs.
Yeah, I think so too. So. And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said, look, the day is now drawing toward evening. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here, that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow go your way early, so that you may get home. However, the man was not willing to spend that night, so he rose and departed and came opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem, with him, and the two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. They were near Jebus, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, "Come, let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." But his master said, "We will not turn aside here into the city of foreigners, who are not the children of Israel. We will go to Gibeah." So he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." And they passed by and went their way. And the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there to go in and lodge in Gibeah. And when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. And when he raised his eyes and he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, the old man said, "Where are you going and where do you come from?" And he said, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I am going to the house of the Lord. But there is no one who will take me into his house, although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for ourselves. For your female servant, and for the young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything." And so, culturally, the people of this city are not doing what's right. They're supposed to take in a stranger, not make him sleep out in the square. And this guy is even saying, "Look, I've got food for me, and for my servants, and for my wife, and for the donkeys, so I just need a bed." Well, nobody would take them in. Okay, so that was inappropriate. And wrong for the people. The old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Do not spend the night in the open square." And he seems very insistent on this. Okay, so the man knows something. So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys and washed their feet, and they ate and drank. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally." But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please. But to this man do not do such a vile thing." But the men would not heed him, so the man took his concubine and brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. Now, at this point, what should this be reminding you of? Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah. If the story sounds familiar, but you're like, "I haven't read this before, but it sounds familiar," it's because it reminds you of Sodom, right? The men came into the house with Lot. He begged them, "Don't stay in the square. Don't stay here. Come into my house. Please do not stay outside." Begs them, insists they come into his house, and then the men of the city come, beat on the door. "Send those men out to us that we can have sex with them." And what did Lot say? "Oh, here's my two daughters. You can have them instead." Story is just repeating. Okay? And what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah?
Utterly destroyed.
Utterly destroyed. Now we find Israel here. Let's continue. "That when the master arose in the morning and opened the doors and went out to his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold." What had he been doing? What was he doing? He arose. He'd been sleeping. He'd been sleeping. And he said to her, "Get up, let us be going." But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of the concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her parts throughout all the territory of Israel. And so it was that all who saw it said, "No such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." So the man slept while his wife was being raped by the city men. They killed her, and then he cuts her up and sends her around the 12 tribes of Israel. This is crazy, right? I mean, it's just, what have we come to? What has the nation come to? And now, on top of all of this, we're going to continue on here till we're out of time. We'll finish next week. But we're going to continue on and see what should happen when the parts of the concubine are sent out to the people. What should they do?
Come and war against whoever sent it?
Well,
repent.
Or at least find out what's going on.
Right, and so they're going to do that, right? And it says that here. They're like, boy, nothing like this ever has been done before. What's going on? We need to consider this. We need to confer together. We need to speak up. Okay? So that's in their mind, right? We're going to get together and talk about this. But what's ultimately going on? Okay? Yeah.
God is sending a picture to them. Kind of reminds me of Jeremiah.
Okay.
When Jeremiah walked around with the yoke on his neck, God was telling the people something. He's trying to get their attention.
Right. And so with that in mind, okay, we're going to continue on with the story here. The people are angry. Okay. The people are upset. They're provoked. Okay. This action is provoking them. The question is, do they respond the right way? Okay, so let's continue on. So all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. And Mizpah is very close by to Gibeah, so they're in the territory of Benjamin for this meeting. And the leaders of all the people, all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. Then the children of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wicked deed happen?" So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "My concubine and I went into Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, to spend the night. And the men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. So I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of the inheritance of Israel, because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel. Look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now." So all the people arose as one man, saying, "None of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000, to make provisions for the people, that when they come to Gibeah and Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel." So all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united together as one man. Then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, "What is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now therefore deliver up the men, the perverted men, who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel." All right, so I'm going to stop there for a second. So what I wanted you to be thinking about is, what is the response of the other tribes? What's their response to the story?
They're incensed.
They're incensed, right? They're
beyond,
angry.
Beyond anger.
Why are they angry? Okay, they're angry about what happened, very specifically, right? Okay, and they see this evil. But who's asking the question why did this evil happen in the first place? Right? So it's very narrow focus. It's very focused on in a myopic way on, we can't believe this kind of thing happened. We've got to purge these people from amongst us. So they have a sense of this sin was really great. I would tell you that to me, they're showing the exact same attitude that the old man and the Levite showed in the city in the first place, right? So what was that attitude? This disgusting sin was offered, so they offered to trade another sin in its place, right? Hey, don't do homosexual sin, but go ahead and do the raping of this girl, okay? And what is that emblematic of? No, it's not profound by any means. I'm asking you a very pedestrian question. What's it emblematic of?
They didn't seek God.
They're not seeking God. They're in a moral mess, right? And we've been studying this all the chapters of Judges. The nation is descending down, down, down into moral confusion and chaos. Okay, and this is not the first time we've seen this happen, where they've got a sense of what's right and wrong, but they don't know specifically what's right and wrong. They don't know their Bibles. They're not properly taught. Okay, so the priest, he knows he's supposed to get married, but he doesn't know to whom he's supposed to get married. And he doesn't know what to do when the woman commits a sin that's worthy of death. So they've got touches of righteousness, but they've got a lot of unrighteousness. And so then when they go to respond to it, they're unable to properly execute justice. They aren't able to properly understand righteousness because their understanding is just messy. What's right? What's wrong? And this is our society today, right? We see this all the time. That's why the church is so confused about homosexuality and homosexual marriage. What's the mantra of the world when it comes to homosexual marriage?
Love.
Love. Why would we stand in the way of two people who love each other? If these two people can get married, then these two people should be able to get married, right? Because it's about love. Marriage is just about love. But marriage isn't just about love, right? We know that because we know what God set up. God didn't just say, hey, any two people who love each other should get married. Okay? A man and a woman should get married. They should leave their parents and become new, a new body, one with God, one with each other. Okay? And so we're seeing again the fundamental loss here of understanding of what's right and what's wrong is leading this nation just into disaster. And so the moral quagmire deepens here. So we're going to continue briefly on. Instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men. Among all these people were 700 select men who were left-handed and could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. Now besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. Then the children of Israel rose and went up to the house of God to inquire of God. They said, which of us shall go up first to the battle against the children of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah first. Okay, so we got 400,000 versus 26,000. Right? It's a pretty big difference, right? Who's in the right? It's not complicated. It's not a trick question. The big group is, right? They've come together because of this great sin that's happened. Okay, they've come together because of this terrible situation. because of the vileness of these men who committed sodomy in the city. They're doing the right thing. And Benjamin's doing the wrong thing, right? Because they should have turned those guilty men over. What were they thinking? Why would they stand to defend these few men of this city? So, what's our natural conclusion? Who's going to win the battle? Right?
The men who are right.
The men who are right. The 400,000, the bigger army, right? This shouldn't really be a contest. So the children of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah, and the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin. And the men of Israel put themselves in battle array to fight against Gibeah. Then the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah, and on that day cut to the ground 22,000 men of the Israelites. And the people, that is the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and again formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves in array on the first day. Then the children of Israel went up and wept before the Lord till evening and asked the counsel of the Lord, "Shall I draw again for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Go up against him." So the children of Israel approached the children of Benjamin on the second day, and Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah on the second day and cut down to the ground 18,000 more of the children of Israel, all those who drew the sword. Two battles. Both with the blessing of God, and they lost both times. Now, there's a lot of other lessons we can take from this besides the moral mess. But I guess, and I'd like to just briefly touch on that, and then we're going to have to wrap up for today, that anybody who talks to us and tells you as a Christian that if you're doing the right thing, God will reward you. That if you're doing the right thing, God's going to grant you victory. That God always blesses with victory those who are fighting for what's right. They're wrong. Because of this story. Okay? God told them, "Go, Judah, you lead the way." They lost. They came back. God, should we do this? He said again, "Go." And they lost a second time. And they lost badly. 40,000 of their 400,000 are now dead. Okay? God does not promise us victory for doing what's right. Not in this life, anyway. Okay? Sometimes doing what's right comes at a very high cost. Sometimes it means losing a job. Sometimes it means losing friends or family. Sometimes it even means losing a life. You look at the martyrs as another prime example, and the easy gospel preachers on television who are like, "Oh, if you do what God wants and send some money, everything's going to be great for you. You're going to get the job, the promotion, the car, the fancy plane, the fancy woman." Okay? That's not true. That's not what the Bible says. Where is our victory? In this world? No. So that's one message that I want to leave you with to think about. We're going to finish the rest of this story. It does not get better. It gets uglier because Israel is in a moral mess. Okay, they are doing two wrongs to do a right. And it's never right to do wrong to do right. Right?
Make a good song.
Have you heard that song? It's never right to do wrong to do right. Okay, so do right, Christian. Do what's right to do. Okay, we'll talk more about this next week, but read ahead. This story is shocking, but it's in the Bible, and there's good lessons to learn.